Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to This is the Place, a podcast series from The Common magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. Today, we'll be talking to Jennifer Jean about her poem, California, which appeared in a special feature of Lusa American Poets on The Common Online. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Jennifer Jean's poetry collections include The Fool and Object Lesson, out this year from Lily Books. Her teaching resource, Object Lesson, A Guide to Writing Poetry, is also out this year. Jennifer's awards include a Kenyon Review Writers Workshop Fellowship, a Disquiet Fellowship to Write and Study Poetry in Portugal, a Her Story Is residency where she worked with Iraqi women artists in Dubai, and an Ambassador for Peace Award for her activism in the arts. She's the translations editor for Talking Writing Magazine and the program manager of 24 Pearl Street, the Fine Arts Works Center's online writing program. She lives in Massachusetts with her husband and children. Jennifer Jean, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Emily. I'm very happy to be here.
We always like to start off by sort of setting the scene. You know, our theme is sense of place. So would you tell us what's the sense of place for where you're calling from today?
Well, the literal space, the immediate space, is my bedroom. I have a very comfortable armchair here that I longed for years and then finally let myself purchase. And I have a wonderful reading lamp and a kitty. It's very writerly here. And this room is located in Peabody, Massachusetts, where I live.
Okay. That's such a nice area. A great museum, right, in Peabody?
It's in the next town over, but it bears the name Peabody. The Peabody Essex Museum is great. I love going there.
Yes, legendary. Would you start off by reading your most recent poem in the Common called California?
Sure. California, after Joni Mitchell, climbing a stone flight in downtown Lisboa, I dodged the disquiet family begging on Rua Garrett, with their rehearsed moans, with their smiling smoke breaks in the alley, by the Parroquia dos Martires. I had seen them, and they'd seen me too, posing the week before in a chair at the Café A Brasileira with the bronze of Pessoa. They nodded, shuffled past. Then my alma immortal sat so straight, I knew my chair held the body that housed my home. I felt like a queen, crab, like California, home. Like there are no strangers in this world, like meeting Miriam Mohsen, at the International in Dubai, linking arms on a water taxi. We own no gripes, no grips or rails or walls between us and the Arabian Sea. She was gorgeous in a magenta turban and jeweled collar pendant. She explained the pelvic benefits of a squat latrine as our skiff surfed along the souk. As I held myself up with my core, I nestled into that night like a foundation stone, like buying my ticket to Seoul, catching a train to Chunshim Lake, going to a party up a red dirt road on Sunun Hill above a cold autumn fog. There were lots of seeking people there, reading Shadows on the Cumulus, reading Sunset Rays over the temples below. I faced east, found I ached like home, and I became the state of California, like a planked pier leaning over the Pacific, or a twilit Ferris wheel there, elevating friends in a gently vertical turn. Like me, they hovered a little above the land, and a breeze made all our eyes water.
Thank you so much for reading that. I am not crass enough to ask a poet what her poem is about, quote unquote, but I wonder if you might tell us what you hope readers or listeners take from the poem, like if there's a heart of the poem.
I think it's fine to ask what a poem's about. and it, I do, because I think that there are several layers to most poems, especially the best ones. And I hope that I'm a person, a poet writing some best poems. So the surface level aboutness for this poem would be that, you know, the speaker is longing for home, and feels at home, you know, longs for home and then realizes that she feels at home no matter where she is, you know, sort of that old adage, home is where the heart is, or wherever you go, there you are, which sometimes has negative connotations to it. Mm-hmm. But in this one, I'm hoping that it's a positive connotation. And then that would be the surface layer aboutness. And then the, I guess, secondary layer, deeper layer would be this attribution that I reference that I gave in the beginning, that this poem is after Joni Mitchell's song, California. And in that song, Joni, I'm calling her Joni like I know her. But anyways, Joni, she's presenting an argument, actually, her, you know, in a way, through her song. I taught composition for 18 years. So I think of things in arguments many times. And she has an argument in her song, which is that she's traveling and she's longing for home, and home is elsewhere, and she can't wait to get back to it. And her home is California. And so in my poem, it's I'm longing for home, and then I realize I am at home wherever I am. You know, so I'm sort of having a counter argument with Joni Mitchell. And I know that many people might not even get to that layer of meaning, that there's a counter argument going on. They might ignore the after Joni Mitchell portion, or that I'm even doing an argument at all, whether it's against someone else's argument or, you know, anything like that. So that's something. I mean, I'm curious what readers think of the poem, because very often I give these explanations and then people say, oh, I thought it was about this other thing. That's usually more beautiful and simple, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely did. I like that the poem can be experienced by someone who is familiar with the Joni Mitchell song and understood in one way and still experienced and enjoyed by someone who's, you know, not familiar with the song or the argument that's happening in it.
Yeah.
I am such a huge fan of Joni Mitchell. I'll call her Joni like I know her.
Wow. Okay.
And I have to say, when they gave Bob Dylan the Nobel Prize for Literature, my first thought was that they'd have to give it to Joni too now. Like, it was just the next step.
Oh my gosh, you're so right. She's an amazing songwriter. I'm in love with her work.
A true poet.
Yes. So
I know that you've collaborated with musicians on past projects as well. Does music factor naturally into your writing process? Does that happen often?
It does happen often, not all the time. This poem is from a series of eco poems I call them eco-ish poems because they're not so straightforward eco poems, that are centered around the place where I grew up in California, the Los Angeles beachside area. Actually, I didn't grow up in the beachside, but I went to the beach often. So it's a sort of Southern California locale. And in that, when I was growing up, there was a kind of music called the California Sound, actually. Joni Mitchell was part of that. She lived in Laurel Canyon. I think she
Canyon.
Yes, the Lady of the Canyon. So she had, you know, she has songs about that. And so when I'm writing this series, or when I've been writing this series, the music factored in. I have a poem called Against the Wind also, which is a Bob Seger song. And I'm not a heavily, you know, a big fan of his as I am of Joni Mitchell or of some of the other songs that have come into the series, this California Sound. However, I just, it was part of my growing up. It's sort of in my DNA. And one other song or group would be The Doors. So I can't tell even now if I actually like The Doors. It just was part of my upbringing. My parents were obsessed with them. And there's even this family legend that my dad, that was debunked like 2 years ago, finally, because I found out through family friends that I thought for my whole life that he had almost been the drummer for the Doors. Like he had auditioned and he was almost going to happen. It wasn't real. It was not a real story. He was just obsessed with them. He was like a weird groupie living in the same town in Venice where they lived back in the 70s. So yeah. So Joni is big. But yeah, many of these artists that are as I said, not so big for me or are just factor in depending on the project. But I have worked in some other favorites of mine. I don't know if you've ever heard of the jazz musician, songwriter, Madeline Peru.
I haven't.
I'm probably pronouncing her name wrong. I should know better. It's probably Peru, Madeline Peru. And in any case, she's an American jazz artist who sings. She's been likened to Billie Holiday, sort of modern Billie Holiday. And I've listened to her work over and over and over, just as much as Joni Mitchell's, and tried to write some work that mirrors the rhythms that I hear, not just like incorporating the words or lyrics. I do that a little bit, but more often that's what I was trying to do with this song also, which is just mirror some of the rhythms. And I wasn't actually too pleased with my reading just now because I usually try to read it as if I'm here listening to the song because it makes the rhythm go the way I want it to go because I'm a free verse writer. So I'm creating my own rhythms in my poems as a free verse writer. And I'm borrowing, as any, you know, I listen to a lot of jazz, so this is going to happen to me a lot. I borrow from a lot of songs and incorporate those rhythms into my own personal rhythms, you know, that are coming from my essence or body or whatever, wherever personal rhythms come from. And I try to work those in and make it create something beautiful for the reader. But your original question was actually, how do I do this a lot? I'd say yes. And I really love collaborating with all kinds of musicians. My husband's a composer, a classical composer, and a oud player, and you know, electric guitar soloist. You know, and I've collaborated with him when I've read my co-translations from the Arabic, which I know we're going to talk about a little bit today. I've read them or performed them alongside his oud playing, because that's a pretty traditional way to do it in Arab countries. So we're just honoring the original writer by doing that.
I love that. I love the idea of sort of collaborating with musicians, either, you know, in the room or from, you know, 3-4 decades ago. Like that sounds like a really exciting and fun creative process to do.
It is. Yeah. And they do feel as if they're, you know, Joni's right with me. You know, I do feel like I'm doing a collaboration in that way. Like I'm in a conversation with them or riffing on their rhythm or something. You know, there's something going on and it's exciting because it sparks something that I wouldn't have necessarily come from me if I wasn't playing off of something else. I think that's the same reason why people write ekphrastic poetry, which is a sort of collaboration with an artist, a visual artist.
I was just going to say that.
That I think we might be almost about to say the same thing, maybe. But you go ahead.
I was just going to ask you. I am not very well versed in poetry, but I love reading poetry. And I was going to ask you if you thought that this counted as ekphrastic poetry, or if that strictly has to be visual art.
There's no strict definition. I have called these sort of collaborations ekphrastic poetry before, but then they're, you know, there are different schools of thought on it. So when I've done that publicly in a performance, I sometimes see raised eyebrows or people come up to me afterwards. No, it's not. But I think it's, the definition isn't very nailed down. It's pretty much the same thing. You're working off of a work of art of some kind. I think there's just no word for this. So right now, yes, ekphrastic, but as far as I know, there's no real word that can be attributed to this kind of play that goes on.
Yeah. Actually, you know, now that we're talking about it, I'm thinking I have written one very short flash fiction piece that is sort of in that vein with a David Bowie song. It tells the story of like the song is when the day you find out that there's 5 years left for Earth and then we're all done. And I just was so, you know, I listened to the song so many times. I had thought about it too many times and I just had to, you know, write something that went along with it. And it was so much fun. It was so different than what I usually do. It was really, it was, you know, I need to commune with David Bowie's music, I think, in some sort of creative way.
Oh, yes. That's another great. I was starting to get into Black Star, his last album, I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And seeing what could come out of that. And now you're inspiring me to go forward with that initial thought to do that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of good stories in there. I mean, he's good for stories.
Yeah, definitely.
I was just going to ask if you could tell us, if there's some specific inspiration for the poem, like, if you wrote it after a certain moment or a certain inspiration, or was it just sort of, like you said, just responding to a song and sort of putting it into the context of your life?
No, there was a moment, you'd mentioned in my bio that I had won a residency in Portugal, in Lisbon, from Disquiet. And when I was there for, I think, almost a month. And it was just because of the way the flight went. You know, the program didn't last a month.
Right.
And I certainly didn't have enough money, by the way, to stay there a month. I just walked around a lot trying to eat very cheaply for quite a bit of that time. But when I was there, it was so odd for me. I mean, I've traveled, but I think I've traveled mostly in groups, and that was the difference. And I went there not knowing anybody. And it sounds unusual. I mean, I don't know, maybe other people travel alone, but I don't. And this time I did, because it just was the nature of the experience. And everything was so unfamiliar, and we had to get to where our classroom was from where we were lodged. And it was all these different ways you could go. And I was shown a couple of times, and at some point I just had to do it myself, of course. Mm-hmm. And they had warned us of pickpockets and all these different things. Mm. And it was so foreign. Like, that word foreign became very real for me more than other places. For some reason, Lisbon, I don't know why. But up until this one moment, I was walking up these, it's right there in the poem. I was walking up these stairs and then it just hit me. This isn't other anymore. This isn't foreign. Like, I felt at home. I could feel that it was okay. And it wasn't that far into the almost month experience. It was like maybe a week and a half. And then after that, I was fine. And it was just really striking. It was very striking. And then I was reflecting on that. And I told one of the other participants that I was starting to tell her this story of what had happened to me. And she said, oh, yeah, I'm so over this place, too. And I said, that's not actually what I mean. I don't feel like I'm over this place. I feel like I'm at home, actually. I feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. Like, everything, I look around and people are just people now. They're just not strangers. And then when I came home and I was starting to write my eco poem series, I was listening to Joni Mitchell, and it all just sort of came together. How I could write about this moment. Her song gave me an entryway into writing about this moment, because in that song, as you know, she's talking about traveling, and it starts in her song. I think she starts off in France, you know, and then she goes to Greece and she goes to all these different places in her song. And so I just thought, I can do that too. That can be the structure of her song, not just the rhythms, which I was heavily trying to follow, with I don't know how much success, but definitely the structure of her song shows up in the poem, where I go from place to place. And instead of longing for home, I'm, as I said earlier, I feel at home. And these are the other two traveled places, you know, in Dubai is the second place. And then the last one is in Korea. I did have those moments. I remembered, you know, when I was trying to create the poem, where else have I felt this? You know, I felt it in these other places. And so I think that's how a lot of people create poems. They're finding a way to talk about something, and form helps, but I'm not a formalist. So this is, she offered this sort of form. Joni did.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I had exactly the same experience. I went to Lisbon for the Disquiet conference. I guess it was in 2019 now.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I was only there for 2 weeks, but I felt the same thing. Like, there's that, I mean, it's the best feeling in the world when you're visiting somewhere and suddenly you feel like you've kind of got it. You've got it in hand. You can handle it now.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Exactly. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe someday I'll be able to write about it, but I haven't yet. I was going to ask, you know, the common we're focused on place. And obviously this poem goes, you know, three different places, as you mentioned, and is an ode to a fourth. Is that something you do often in terms of like writing about places, or is it, does it just sort of depend on the poem?
It does depend on the poem. And I might even say the poem series, because I tend to write in series. And I mentioned earlier the eco-poem series that I'm writing. It's called the Pacific series. And that's just, I wrote that here in Peabody. You know, looking back, I haven't lived in that part of California for 25 years.
Oh, wow.
I'm revealing my age a little bit here. But in any case, it's been a long time. And I was doing this, I was a judge for this wonderful contest called the Bow Seat. Bow Seat. I don't know what the full name of it is, but it's a contest for high school and middle schoolers who write poetry, fiction, and do visual arts to express their feelings about and to fight, pollution and climate change and things like that. So they're all right in the, and I was doing this, I think in around 2016 or something, I was judging this contest and there's like thousands of entries that you have to go through. So I was reading poem after poem after poem from these kids from around the world writing about the ocean. And it just made me keep thinking about California and where I grew up and going to the beaches. And I'm here in Peabody and it is a nice area here, except it's just not the same. It's like in no way the same. And just my imagination was ignited by reading these kids' poems. And I just was going to that place. And I was thinking about how geography is so embedded in me and how Californian I am. Like, I don't feel like in terms of identity, that's pretty high up on my list. And not even Californian. Because I lived in San Francisco for a while. So I would say Southern Californian is very much there in my DNA. And it was very easy for me to travel there in my memory, in my mind. And I did research, you know, I went online because I didn't remember everything.
Right.
But I could tell that because I would ask people that were there, like, can you read this poem? Am I getting this right? This place, right? And they would say, yes. So because it's so much in me, doing, you know, incorporating research seemed to work according to these people that I had check out my poem to make sure, you know, my various place poems to make sure that they're correct or authentic or whatever you want to call it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah, that's so interesting. You know, now that you mention it, like, I know that you live in Massachusetts, but when I read the poem, I just assumed that you lived in California. you convinced me.
Oh, good. That's good to hear.
So your new poetry collection, Object Lesson, it just came out at the beginning of this year, and it came out with a companion guide as well. Would you tell us a little bit more about both of those books?
Yes. So Object Lesson is a collection about, it's exploring the issue of human trafficking and more specifically sex trafficking in America. And that collection actually was originally very long. And I started writing it in about 2012 after I heard a sermon from my pastor who had, she had an experience in Las Vegas, an encounter with human trafficking. I should be more specific, with sex trafficking. And it just really hit me very, very hard. I just started crying. And it just, and the pastor said, you know, I'm a pastor. This community is my way of helping the world. But if anyone out there wants to address this issue, this is very important, something like that. And I just felt like, well, I'm just a writer. What can I do? Mm-hmm. And then I started thinking about that and I was sort of challenged by my own question. What can I do about this issue? And I thought I can pay attention to it because that's what writers do. That's what artists do. Mm-hmm. We pay attention and I have a choice about what I pay attention to. So I started to do research. I started to volunteer as a poetry teacher at a safe house. I started to volunteer as a blog writer for an survivor advocate organization. And I also started to realize that I had my own life story was a bit affected by this issue because I started seeing through my research and going to all these various events and hearing survivors of sex trafficking talk about where they came from and their history and how they match the typical mm-hmm. trafficked person. And that's it. And their story matched my story up to a point because so many of them were, I'm not going to tell my whole life story, but one thing that's really big is that I was from age 7 months to age 7 years old was in foster care. Mm-hmm. And that really affected my life quite a bit. And so, and this is a huge statistic. So many people coming out of foster care, but mostly girls, and they are victims of coercion and coerced into the sex trafficking lifestyle. So, mm-hmm. yeah. And I remember times in my life where that could have happened to me, actually. And I realized my crying was not just, I'm just moved by this, important issue, but that there was something going on. It was sort of like for what could have happened to me.
Right, right.
Yeah. So I explored it through poetry because I'm a poet. So that's mm-hmm. what I wanted to do. And I also wanted to empower the people who had actually survived this experience because I had not. I mm-hmm. wanted to empower them. So as I said, I taught poetry classes to just teach how to tell your own stories in these compressed ways, in poems, in a few places. I did that. And then when it came time for me to publish the book, I asked my publisher if I could, I think it was a sort of, she had the idea as well. I realized I asked her, but she was thinking of it anyways. And I'm so happy about that.
That's nice.
Yeah. If I could publish a guide to writing poetry based on the book, my collection, but more to teach how to write poetry, specifically geared towards survivors of trauma in general. But my hope is that sex trafficking survivors, especially, can the organizations that deal with them can take up the book and find folks who want to teach their population and utilize this book. I tried to keep it very simple. It's a super short little book, and I'm very happy about it. Yeah. So that's how that all came about.
That's so great. I love the idea of the companion guide. I read in your bio that you founded Free to Write, which is poetry workshops for trauma survivors. Could you just tell us just a little bit about that?
Yeah, I founded that when I started to do the poetry workshops at the safe house, the initial safe house I worked at. And I did that to sort of, I don't know. I think I had a kind of a grand vision at first that I would create this this curriculum, which I ended up doing. I mean, that's what that book is. The guide to writing poetry is a sort of curriculum. but also just as a, I don't know what the right word is, a clearinghouse or resource center for folks, teachers of other teachers of trauma survivors, different kinds of traumas, because those, it's sort of a community that's out there. And it didn't really take off very much. I'm a mom with, and at the time I had, my kids were young. I couldn't devote as much time as I wanted to it. So we, I do have a website that's populated with some things. But my hope was to do a lot more with it. Right now it's on hiatus. Mm-hmm. So it's just, my life has taken different turns. My kids are now grown, because this is, as I said, I began this in 2012. It's quite a time ago. So I might get back to it, or if I found, and this is a good time to say this because this is a public podcast, if I were able to partner with someone or find someone who wanted to take up the cause, right, and I could, right, bequeath the things that I've learned and maybe the website, I'd be happy to do that. Because it's just, yeah, my life has gone in so many directions. And I think the wind was taken from my sails, to use an overused phrase, because the book itself wasn't published right away. And I think that kind of got to me. I finished it pretty quickly. And all the poems in the book were published, actually, in the larger manuscript. Mm-hmm. That's a ton of poems published, yeah, but I could not find a press for it. And I started to wonder if, of course you wonder about the quality, so I would just constantly check over the quality, but then they were getting published. And I did wonder if people were a bit wary of the topic. And I realized that I started getting a little bit miffed at that. But then I thought, you know what? This is hard. This is hard topic for people to think about, to talk about, to confront. I started to think about when I would give readings and I would read these poems without giving anybody any warning. I was sort of an assault on people. Assault is kind of strong, but it was like people were really affected and they looked, just not prepared to be affected. So I decided to change how I do readings. And when the book came out, I did this too. I consciously did this where I would prepare people for what they were going to hear and thank them for being open-hearted and open and having an open mind and receiving this information. That's difficult. And I wish I would have thought of that earlier when I was trying to send the book out. It took, so many, from 2012 to just, as you said, recently to the publication, for me to pretty much realize that. And I think it would have been better. I would have had more momentum for this and been able to give a lot more back to the cause if I had thought about that, taking into consideration audiences. I don't know how often you've heard people talk about this. I never hear people talk about that. Like, what is the, what can I do for the audience to receive this more easily? So it was a hard knock lesson for me, I think, because it wasn't taught directly to me to think about that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that as writers, we're very often told to be sort of pure and not think about the artists. And there's this big, big energy for never thinking about your reader, because it will just, lead you astray or make you too nervous to write or something like that. And I think that you're right, that there is a time and a place in your writing process, probably not the beginning, but maybe at the end, to think about readers and what they might need. And also, I think you should be forgiving with yourself, because I think the idea of, content warnings or trigger warnings are something that we are all familiar with now, but we definitely were not in 2012. I think that idea of, the emotional cost of reading and encountering certain kinds of content, we weren't really thinking about that very much in 2012.
You're right. Yeah, that's true.
I just wanted to say that for anyone who's interested in the things you're talking about, the free to write workshops or the object lesson companion guide, we can definitely link those from the show notes so people can find them online.
That's great. Thank you for doing that. Yeah, I was just going to say that I don't even think of it as a trigger warning, like when I say it, just as a slight differentiation. I think of it more as just gratitude to people for being present. It just feels a little different. But it does serve as a trigger warning as well, in case someone just doesn't want to, or it isn't good for them. They know themselves that it isn't right for them to hear certain things. you know, especially in a public place, that they're just sitting there and this information's coming at them. But really, for most people haven't encountered this. That's my experience. So for those, and those folks would have reactions too. So for them, it's a, I'm thinking a gratitude and being present and just a preparation and a working up to the topic.
Right. Yeah. I like that. Like a gratitude for listening and sort of encountering the material. Mm-hmm. So the Common also published some work that you co-translated from Arabic with Amir al-Azraqi by two woman poets from Iraq. And in the translator's note, you outline the really fascinating process of translating from a language that you don't actually personally speak. And you've included some comparison lines of sort of straight, what I would call literal translation alongside the final, more poetic lines. Would you talk a little bit more about that process?
Yes. That was such a surprise to me to be suddenly translating. I never saw myself doing that. I've only ever spoken English. And when I first became involved with the Her Story Is Collective in 2017, I believe, I was able to, I think you mentioned this in the bio, I was able to travel to Dubai and meet these wonderful women artists from Iraq and get to know them. They were just amazing. And it was after that experience that I felt like, okay, you know what? It kind of harkens back to this California poem, because that experience in Dubai is mentioned in the poem. An experience from Dubai is mentioned in the poem where I meet this one woman, Mary Mosum. We have this connection, and that sort of connection with those women. And I've met international people over my whole life, but just that one, it was something very special about this Her Story Is Collective. There's something about just women coming together. And we were in a neutral space too, not in each other's country. It was an Arab country, but very westernized. And so it just felt neutral. And it's just really intriguing. I felt like, okay, there is a way to connect through language to another culture. I could feel it, because we were working through translators the whole time we were there. And so when Amr, who I co-translated these poems with, he was there. He was one of our translators in Dubai. I think he was one of two men that were present. That everybody else, it was all women otherwise. And when we came back, he had already been co-translating with someone. And I just thought, okay, I want to do a Her Story Is initiative that brings Arab women poetry to English-speaking audiences, not just American audiences, but English-speaking audiences. And I just felt like, okay, how can I do this? I only know English. And Amr had already been doing this process. And he said, okay, yeah, let's try this together. You know, I've done this before. So he had done this. And we worked out a process that worked for us, which, as you said, is in that translator's note. And so it's a very scary process, actually. There's a lot of trust that's involved. From the poet, you know, first of all, letting their poem, because we work with only living poets. We're not doing, like most translators, working with people who are long passed away. Mm-hmm. We're working with folks that we can actually ask them questions. And so Amr he already had a batch of poems from women that he'd gotten. He's a playwright and he's well connected throughout the Arab world and in the arts. So he was able to collect some poems, and he would do this raw translation. And I'm trying to say some different things than what I said in that note, but in any case, did the raw translation. And then I would be confronted with this really awkward thing in English very often. And it just was, sometimes it would really make me scared and just have an emotional reaction of, how am I supposed to make this make sense? You know, it challenged my connection to English, actually. Right. And I had to really consider each word. And so I would just write a couple of different versions sometimes, and I would have a ton of questions, and then I would give those to Amr. And then he's a playwright, as I said, not a poet. Mm-hmm. And he told me he does not feel confident to translate poetry, which I thought was interesting, because he speaks both languages beautifully, English and Arabic. You know, by all accounts, I was told about the Arabic that he speaks it beautifully and knows it very well. And he's from Iraq. That's his native language. But he did not feel confident. He felt like he had to work with an English-speaking poet. So he would take those questions and go to the to the poet and ask the questions, or he would try to figure it out as much as he could himself. And we'd go back and forth until something, there would always be this moment, again, to go back to the California poem, sort of this epiphany kind of moment where I would feel at home. Actually, it's very similar. Just in the translation, do it in the process, I would feel at home with a phrase. Usually it's phrase by phrase, not always the whole poem at once. That didn't really happen. But as things would go along, I would suddenly start to feel at home with what was being talked about, you know, and how the poet was approaching it, and any kind of patterns that were emerging that I could try to retain in English. And once that happened, I felt like, okay, I could do this. And I would gain some confidence, and we would just have a few more back and forths, and then the poem would be finalized eventually. So I don't know if I answered your question quite.
Yeah, no, you absolutely did. It's something that always fascinates me, because your poem, your translation of that poem is not the first poem that we've published like that, where sort of a translator maybe collaborated with someone who doesn't speak the language, or a poet, or someone to sort of help with the finessing of the language and sort of finalizing it. And it always intrigues me. And I also think the work that comes out of those collaborations is always really beautiful. And you know, it's not just about meaning and making sure the meaning comes across, but getting across some of the language and the rhythm and stuff. And I mean, that I find it endlessly fascinating that anyone is capable of translating poetry, because it always just strikes me as being sort of untranslatable, you know, in terms of rhythm and rhyme and word sound and that kind of thing.
Well, it is untranslatable. And I think because it might be the case because I only know English, although I'm studying Korean, by the way, but because I only know English, that I feel okay about the fact that things aren't able to be translated, because I live in one language. So I know, like, I can't get that thing. I can't get at certain things in another language. So I can let go of that. I think when people hold on to that too much, it can impede the translation process, or they don't even want to do it because they just think this is impossible. But I was told something very interesting when I was in Lisbon. Keep returning back to this Lisbon thing, but by a very young translator, what is Bruna? I'm forgetting her last name. But anyways, a Brazilian translator named Bruna. She said that she had sort of a theory of translation that she had either learned, or I don't know if she had come up with it, but I loved it, which is that, and she was a lone translator. She didn't do co-translation. She did both sides, from the Portuguese to English and back and forth. And she said that a translation is a work of art. It's its own thing, you know, separate from the work of art that was original. And I think that's pretty controversial. When she said it, I was like, really? That can be, that's allowed? And she's like, it's just a way that you could think about this if you want to. And, Bruna Lobato, I think that's her name.
Oh, we published her.
Yes, you have. Yes.
she wrote a story for us.
Yeah, she's fabulous. But when she said that, I thought, okay, I hope I'm not misinterpreting what she said, but that's what I got from what she said, is that it's its own work of art. So then hearing that, and I didn't hear that too long before I started translating. I think I heard it in a couple of months before I actually started this process. So it was still very fresh for me. And I just thought, it's okay, as long as someone who is a native speaker signing off and who can communicate, you know, and who can communicate with the original author. So they're the author and this co-translator signing off on this art object, that I'm not totally, you know, misrepresenting their work, because I'm still representing their work, but it's severed enough from it that it's its own work of art. I still would never say, like, here's my work, you know, and it's that person's work. I wouldn't do that. That's not what I'm saying. I hope no one out there thinks that, but it's more just, it's just it's further along from what I was doing, let's say, with Joni Mitchell, with the California, like I'm riffing on the rhythms. I'm doing what I can. I'm responding to certain things. That's one kind of way of translation in a way. It's lighter. But this is more direct, because I'm actually using the concepts and the arrangement of their concepts. You know, I'm following that, and I'm trying to get as close as I can to anything they're trying to say, and and represent it to the new audience, the English speaking audience. So that's new great. Work of art.
Yeah, that does sound a little bit like the riffing on Joni Mitchell that you mentioned before. That's an interesting comparison. Would you just, in case our listeners aren't familiar with that organization, Her Story Is, would you just tell us briefly what that organization does?
Yes. Her Story Is it's an initiative by the Fort Point Theater Channel, which is a collective of playwrights and other kinds of artists. And that group started Her Story Is because I think that it grew out of a collaboration with Four Point Theater and the William Joyner Institute originally. They had this collaboration between American artists and Iraqi artists to sort of restore relationships between the two nations. This happened like sooner after America was in Iraq in a contentious way. So that's when that first happened. And then Her Story Is became, you know, the women that were involved with that wanted to just make it, develop it further and make it just an all-women's collaborative. And it was begun by Anne Lawyer, and another person heavily involved is Amy Merrill. And they're primarily playwrights. I think Anne Lawyer is also a visual artist, but they were interested in this sort of restorative relationships, you know, bringing former enemy nation folks together around the art, centered around the arts, to collaborate, to understand each other, to heal past wounds, to understand each other. I mean, this is what was done back in the 80s, I believe, with between the Soviets and America, right? Mm-hmm. I forget what that was called. There's a certain name that I told myself to remember, but I cannot. But
yeah, to bring them together.
Yeah, I can't quite remember, but to bring, you know, it can begin with art. Peace, like real peace and restoration, can begin with artists. It's a one way to go, mm-hmm. you know, where you just bring the artists together and they link up and they create relationships and they exchange culture, you know, and they honor each other's culture too. And in that way, restore things, restore and not just normalize, but heal and recreate anew the relationship between the countries. So it's not just based on past wars, you know?
Right.
So we came together as Her Story Is people that are coming together in that group come together as equals. So it's not that we are the bad colonialists and yeah. they are the sufferers. It's not like that, because we do it like that, then it's a patronizing kind of relationship. It's instead, these Iraqi women are amazing, completely educated, and want their stuff out into the world. Mm-hmm. They want to be translated. They want, you know, us to share their work and to collaborate with them. And they want to share our work with their countrymen and their country folk. And they're translating my poems have been translated into Arabic and shared.
That's so cool.
So yeah. So, and it's going, and right now Her Story Is has a play that's, with Iraqi, Tunisian, and American playwrights collaborating together, because in Tunisia they speak Arabic and French. So it's French, Arabic, English. I don't think there's a fourth language, but it's in all those languages all at the same time. It's pretty amazing what they're doing, and it's all over Zoom, and they had a reading recently. And I'm collaborating with this amazing poet, Hana Ahmed. We're doing poem exchange based on place, actually, where we write about a place in our country, and then we respond to each other's poem about that place in the best way that we can, like reflecting on whatever the other person said. And yeah, and eventually, hopefully that poem exchange will turn into something published out into the world. That would be great. But yeah, that's Her Story Is.
That's
and yeah, it's great. I love it.
We'll definitely link that in the show notes as well, so people can find out more about it.
Great.
Always my last question is what are you working on now? Like, what should we look for next from you? Not like you didn't just put a book out, but like, what's next?
Well, what is next? I think that my hope is to have my manuscript, The Pacific, with the eco poems out mm-hmm. in the world. I've been sending that out. That's what I'm dreaming towards. I'm, you know, aiming towards to be out in the world.
Right.
In a more immediate way, I mean, folks could go to my website, jenniferjohnwriter.weebly.com, and I have an events page, and I have a ton of events that I'm doing where I read more poems from Object Lesson and from the Pacific series, because that's where a lot of my focus is as well. And also I read co-translations in those events. I'm trying to think of anything upcoming. I think I have a Hudson Valley Writers Center reading in August, but I probably have other things sooner. April 21st, Lily Books, my press for Object Lesson, we're having Lily Readers reading, Lily Books reading. I'm misrepresenting that name, but in any case, that's also on my website. But yeah, I'm really excited about these eco poems. I want to get that book out there and continue to promote, as you said, Object Lesson, which just came out.
That's great. That sounds great. Yeah, we can definitely link to those. And I also look forward to seeing the eco poems out in the world. It just sounds fantastic. And I would love to finish up by having you read one of those co-translated Arabic poems that we talked about earlier. If you could read Definitions by Nadia Al-Khatib. I love that poem.
Yes. My heart is a pear your pocket can't contain. My heart is poorly stored. It starts to rot. My story, I'm a girl tempted into a wonderland. The more truth I know here, the less joy I know everywhere. Our meetings are marked by the knife of the past, and my feet can't run in your gorgeous garden, where death overtakes the body of my story. Should I repair your wings for you to fly out of this love story?
Thank you so much for reading that and for joining us today. It's been so great to talk with you, Jennifer.
Thank you so much, Emily. I've enjoyed it.
Listeners, you can read Jennifer's poems and subscribe to the magazine at thecommononline.org.